Good evening, and welcome to this meeting of the San Francisco Ethics Commission. I will call the commission to order and call the roll. Commissioner Hansen.
Present.
Commissioner Ward.
Here.
Commissioner Herr.
Here.
Thank you very much. We will open with public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda that are within the Ethics Commission jurisdiction. Is there anyone who'd like to make public comment at this time? And I'll mention, if should you want to, later on, there is public comment on each of the action items that follows. Thank you. We have a significant set of recommendations before us on possible amendments to the campaign consultant ordinance and extensive materials that have been available for review on the proposed amendments, the effect of the changes, the ordinance themselves. And thank you very much for the history. That was good to have the original underlying materials. We will proceed tonight in the following way. We'll address, I'd like to hear from staff if you want to say anything on an introductory basis about this, although the memo was good and helpful that brought it before us. We will start with the recommendations, the decision items that have been denominated significant, and work through those. We'll then see if there are any that the staff has identified as technical or not significant that the commissioners know they want to talk about substantively and deal with those, and then we will take all the remaining items and deal with them as a group and see if we're comfortable acting on them together. It is possible that we will decide that there's more discussion about these than we can get through tonight, but let's see what we think as we go forward. It is the main agenda item on our docket, so we have a good full meeting's worth, but I don't want to if there's significant discussion, it might suggest that we want to do more work or have questions answered for us. Or split it up into two so that we can have can be clear about these. But with that, Mr. St. Croix has indicated that the staff is ready to have us just roll into the entire group. With that, we will move to the discussion items and the decision points, starting with the ones denominated on page 2 as major substantive changes. Which would, I'm pausing to make sure this still makes sense as a process matter. People think that works? In which case, we'll move to number 2, which appears on page 2. So in each case, I'd be interested in whether commissioners have questions or want clarification, and then policy discussion on the merits. So section 1.505, any clarification or questions or comments?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
To me, this may be the most significant of all the changes that now the Ethics Commission and the Board of Supervisors can change the ordinance rather than it having to go back to the voters. So my question is, what is the compelling reason for that change?
Generally speaking, it's the process for making legislative change is much easier if it goes through a supermajority of the Ethics Commission and then a supermajority of the Board of Supervisors. This is what happened in the campaign finance reform ordinance that was adopted, and also in the government ethics ordinance, as well as not the lobbyist ordinance. But those two ordinances, when they began, they were voter-initiated ordinances, and then subsequently they were changed by the voters to say that the Board of Supervisors by supermajority can make a change to those ordinances as long as the Ethics Commission also agree by a 4/5 majority. So basically, this is a time-saving mechanism. It enables us to address changes that we think are necessary, and it enables us to address them in a more timely fashion. Because if you have to put something on the ballot, this is something that has to go before the voters right now. If it has to go to the voters, it's a more time-consuming process. It means that we have to spend time educating, well, it's good to educate the voters, but we have to spend time doing that. We also have to follow certain schedules, certain procedures. So this is just really a time-saving device.
So let me ask you, I understand that this has to go before the voters. In what degree of, what level of detail is this presented to voters?
It's pretty much what you see in that Prop G. What you see is that there will be a digest, and then the law itself will be presented with the marked changes. So they will see what you see in this document here.
And then they're given the option to vote yes or no based on all of the changes.
Exactly.
Not exactly.
One by one. It's a whole package.
The entire package.
If I could add, as you know, we do changes to CFRO several times every year. And if we didn't have that authority that the voters gave us to do that, those things would have to wait to the next election every time we do them, excuse me, and then go through the process that all ballot measures do. And once the Ethics Commission has signed off on these measures, we are no longer allowed to utter any opinions or anything publicly about them. So we'd be restricted from supporting or opposing our own work in the case just of the campaign consultant ordinance, not everything else we do. I don't anticipate after we do this that there will be lots of changes, but as Mabel said, it would be time-saving. I mean, it's a big responsibility we're asking for, but we're asking the voters. We're not giving it to ourselves. So I just wanted to point that.
I have a question about the scope. When it says that we can make changes to the ordinance, what are there any limitations on the scope of the changes that we made, or remind us what the standard is? How is the consistency with the voter passed ordinance cabined?
Deputy City Attorney Andrew Shen, Chair Studley, there's no limitation. I mean, it's however you want to construct it. As it's currently constructed, the supermajority of the Ethics Commission and the supermajority of the board can make further changes to the campaign consultant ordinance and to any section of the campaign consultant ordinance. Certainly, you could draft it in a way that you could restrict yourself to certain portions of the ordinance if you so wish to do so. But as it's currently written, you can do any section, and that mirrors CFRO and Chapter 2 of Article 3 as well.
Forgive me, I do think there is a limitation, because in the CFRO, when we make changes at the commission and the board, the language says it has to be for the purposes of furthering the ordinance.
That's true.
I did omit to mention that.
That language is included in the...
Right. So, and we have understood that to limit us from certain kind of going back or withdrawing from the purpose. We could achieve the purpose in a different way. We could administer it as long as we thought it still had the same positive effect. Commissioner Ward, did you have any other questions or comments?
I had a similar question, but just to follow up on the furthering the ordinance, we understand that language to also relate to this ordinance, correct?
If it's adopted, yes.
Yes, okay.
Is actually in the proposed ordinance itself that it furthers the purposes of the ordinance.
Not to belabor the issue, so just briefly, I think it's a significant decision to not go back to the voters and to take something away from voter approval, which is how I see it, is not to be taken lightly. And even though that's what we do with CFRO, I have concerns about doing that with this one. And I would like to see some discussion. Currently, I would not support it. I'd like to see some discussion with the board to understand how the board feels about this. I don't know how often that occurs. And for us, I think it's maybe only been with CFRO. I'm not sure. That's the only one that I recall where we've made changes to something that was voter approved initially. But in any case, it gives me pause.
Can I just add a clarification? It is also part of the government ethics ordinance. So when we make changes to the conflict of interest laws, this provision, a very similar provision, also governs.
Great. Thank you.
I think these are good points. I think of this as a decision whether to allow the voters to make this change. We can't alter it by ourselves, so it's whether we should allow them to make that decision. But that then raises a practical question of whether if the voters didn't like this part but were comfortable with the rest of the package, mm-hmm. whether it might
absolutely
slow down the whole thing or crater the otherwise acceptable suggestions if they separated this, the precedent that there are two other provisions, two other arenas of regulation that we handle in the same way might mean that would not be a voter issue, but at least thinking about it.
I think that's why I asked my question about how it's presented
exactly,
to the voters.
Exactly, right. Is it one piece at a time?
Yeah, so that is presented to the voters all or nothing, I would not be inclined to support this particular change.
Do we have the sometimes I recall on our lengthy ballots that we have propositions that are 1A, 1B. Do we have the option of or the ability to recommend that it be in two parts, this and everything else? I truly don't know what the ballot
Yeah, I think Deputy City Attorney Anderson, I think theoretically you could actually do it as mm-hmm. two separate measures. And I guess you could have a series of substantive amendments in one measure and then have an additional measure just on the ability of the Ethics Commission Board to make further amendments. And that would obviously be contingent on the substantive amendments passing in the first place. Or I suppose you could have all the substantive amendments without this provision, allowing the board and the Ethics Commission to amend in another version with all the amendments and with that provision. So I guess there's a couple ways you could go about it. And the general rule is when you have two measures on the same issue and there's a conflict between the two, whichever one receives a higher number of votes is the one that prevails. It depends how you could structure, but you could theoretically you could do both. I would say stepping away a little bit away from my shoes as a deputy city attorney, there is also, I would think, it could be a concern that voters would be confused. When you have multiple measures on a single subject, I have seen in the past few years in City Hall that sometimes voters feel a little overwhelmed by being faced by that situation.
Even more overwhelmed than they are by the ballot itself. I'm not sure that those are all the options. I don't know that one is contingent on the other, but I think that kind of judgment might be hard to make here quickly just thinking about it for the first time. So just a minute. Let's hear from Commissioner Hansen.
Just to add to that, I don't think I'd be in favor of having two measures. I think it's very confusing to the voters, and I think there's enough on the ballot already. But so I'm not, anxious to put something else on the ballot, and I know it's a delay in time, and it's a cost, certainly. I think because the process would be very thorough and complete between us and then would go to the board, and I expect that the board would have a thorough discussion, by the end of that, it makes sense to me that the package would be presented to the voters. So I guess I'm trusting that the process would be lengthy enough and thorough enough that by the time it gets to the voters, it will reflect, what we think is appropriate to put on the ballot.
Do you have an additional comment? I have a suggestion on this one, given that we're opening with a complicated one that may depend on how we feel about the rest of the package. And since I mentioned the possibility that we'll want to see whether we can do them all tonight, if there is a motion, I'm happy to entertain a motion. But we could hold this one till the end of the group and act on it at that point. And if that means that it's at this meeting, we will at least know what the package is and the degree of complexity and difference of opinion there is or is not on it. And if we have a set that goes over, we can think about it and possibly get some advice about how it could be structured. So is there a motion that one of you would like to make at this time?
I would make a motion to hold it.
I don't know. I don't think we need a motion.
Right,
I don't think
that,
we need a motion to hold it. I just didn't want to run it on somebody who wanted an act. Right.
Okay.
And if there isn't one,
then we'll just hold on it. Okay.
As far as public comment, I think these are complicated enough that I'll take public comment, certainly on the substantive, major substantive changes one by one. So is there any public comment on decision point number two? Seeing none, we will move to decision point 3A, which is the next one identified as substantive. Are there questions, comments from the commissioners?
I have some concerns about this because I think it's ambiguous. I think how it, without the added phrase, I think the provision worked fine, and I'm worried that adding it just adds additional complexity and ambiguity as to who are those who perform campaign consulting services and who do not as far as employees of a campaign consultant.
I just want to make sure I understand your comment, Commissioner Herr, and that is on page 3, line 3.
Mm-hmm.
Your suggestion is to remove that inclusion.
Correct.
Okay.
I mean, it seems to me if we have the campaign consultant, that person's employees, whether that be the person, the individual, or the entity, would otherwise be covered, and I worry that it's confusing to add this phrase.
I think you're correct. No, I'm fine with that change.
So the sentence would read with that change?
The term campaign consultant does not include employees of a campaign consultant, comma.
Attorneys
who provide only legal services.
And my comment would be that I'm concerned about the drop in the level of economic consideration from 5 to 1. I understand the argument that rarely happens, but I think as a standard and as a message to the public, we should hold to the $1,000 figure.
I'll just mention, you obviously understand the effect, but I think you misstated the direction. You said drop from 5 to 1.
Yes. I'm sorry.
Would not
the other way. I'd keep it at 5,000.
I'm sorry.
No.
Keep it at 5?
No.
We're increasing.
I suggest keeping it the same as it is, which
keep
is
it at
now
1,000.
Okay. My comment on that is that, although we've not reached that area of the proposal, is that we're recommending a flat fee, a flat registration fee for all campaign consultants.
Right.
So somebody who makes $1,000 would have to pay $500 to register. I just think that's a bit too much.
I would agree.
I think when we get to the fee, if we're going to link those two, then we need to discuss them together because we may have questions about the fee. And we can't presume that one will pass when we act on this one.
Right. And I agree with you. Also, as we mentioned, there are very few campaign consultants who earn less than $5,000. And we want to make sure that the people who are engaged in grassroots political consulting or people who don't earn very much can continue to do that without having to register and pay fees with the Ethics Commission.
Do you have a number of people who have earned less than $5,000 maybe over the course of the last 12 to 24 months?
We don't have the final number for this particular year, but as of right now, there are three consultants who earned less than $5,000 in the last 12 months.
Out of
47.
Any other comment?
I think that given the cost, and I understand we'll get there later, but the cost of administering the program and sort of the burden the fees would have on someone only earning $1,000, I think moving it to $5,000 is appropriate.
Commissioner Harriman? I'm sorry, Hanson. I turn right and
I'll soon
see
they
her.
Forget. Well, when we get there, I will support the current fees because I agree that $500 if you make $1,000 is not appropriate. I think it's more important to set the standard. We have three people. That's three people. It's, you know, not a significant percentage of 47, but there are three people, and I would like to know what they're doing as consultants.
And I'll just go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say I'd support this this change with the additional change that was just proposed about the phrase.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem with raising it to $5,000 if someone wants to make a motion that we adopt this with the provision to make the adjustment to the phrase that was.
And I'll just mention because it made. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to ask procedurally, can we, with only four commissioners, we need 4/5, so we would need a unanimous? No. We can just do a simple majority. Okay, thank you.
And I'll just say that I am comfortable with changing the threshold to 5,000 as well. If we had zero, or I thought that the voters wanted us to have zero anytime somebody takes a penny, I might not want to vary from that. But given that we have a notion of a small or de minimis level at which it becomes burdensome to do any kind of assistance to a campaign, it seems to me 5 is reasonable, and that 1,000 is the cost-benefit analysis to the voters allows me to say that it could be 5. So let's see if someone wants to make a motion, and then we'll take public comment.
I move that we adopt decision point 3A, except that we do not include the phrase that appears on line 3 of page 3.
Do I hear a second?
I'll second that.
Public comment? Any further discussion? I know sometimes you like to hear if there's public comment. Any further discussion on that one before the vote?
I would just say I'll vote against it, and I will say that my theme tonight is really in response to what I see as a drop in transparency through many of these changes. And I do think this ordinance is a service to the public. I do think that it's important just to have this information reported. And that, to me, is what we're changing, that we're saying that some people can do consulting and not report, and other people will need to. And that's a concern to me.
All in favor of the motion to adopt decision point 3A with the change that we will delete the phrase who do not perform campaign consultant services. Please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Thank you very much. The next one denominated significant is decision point 5A. Which would shift, let's see what, right, okay, related to the registration of campaign consultants. Comments and discussion?
The only question I had about this was what was the original intent of a campaign consultant having to register with the tax collector?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I've tried to ascertain that, but I couldn't.
I have also have a question about this, and I wonder if I'm looking for the intent. I'm looking for why we would take it out. I don't know what we get from having it. I wonder if by taking it out, well, I wonder if someone could be a campaign consultant and then not be paying their business tax as a registered San Francisco business. And I wonder if that was some of the purpose that someone operating in San Francisco as a consultant needed to be paying their city taxes. I don't know that we want to support a consultant not being registered. At the same time, I don't know if it's our job to kind of police that, if you will.
I don't have an answer to that. I do know that lobbyists are not required to disclose this kind of information under the lobbyist ordinance. So.
Right. And the telling us whether they are required to do so doesn't change their underlying obligation. Could you just, in part for the record, tell us what the ambiguity is now in existing law, just so that when we act on this, people know what we are attempting to either fix or leaving in place if we need to resolve the ambiguity some other way.
One of the purposes the staff wanted to do was to streamline the ordinance as much as possible so that what we deem to be extraneous stuff no longer stays in the ordinance. The ordinance is 13 years old. There's a lot of things that were in it. No one is sure why they were in it, but when we're looking at it, looking through it with, you know, these years of administration, we're saying, you know, nobody really knows why this is done. And is it really needed? Does it really serve the purposes of the ordinance? And this is one of those things that, I mean, does this really serve the purposes of the ordinance? So that's really...
You may be speaking to either a broader set or to this tax collector item. I'm just looking at the paragraph 5A registration requirements that says this clarifies an ambiguity related to the business days of qualifying as a campaign consultant.
I'm sorry.
I didn't tell you where that was. It's just that... And I believe we have talked about that uncertainty in the past. So.
Yes. Let me just look at the original.
The last thing we want is people sitting out there trying to know when they're supposed to do something or they're in a catch-22.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. If you look at the ordinance, the current ordinance itself, it says at the time of initial registration, each campaign consultant shall report to the Ethics Commission the following information. It doesn't say when you're supposed to do this. Nowhere in the ordinance does it say when. So we're saying do it within 5 business days of qualifying.
Okay.
That's really what it is.
Anyone?
I have a question about section A4. Who was intended to be affected by the phrase employee of the campaign consultant's employer? because I thought a campaign consultant was either an individual or an entity. And if it's an individual, then that would be captured by the employee of the campaign consultant. And if the campaign consultant is an entity, then it would also seem to be covered by any employee of the campaign consultant.
I think I understand it.
I think maybe this is something that we weren't careful enough when we were drafting this. I think Commissioner Herr makes a good point. A statement whether the campaign consultant or any employee of the campaign consultant is required to register with the Ethics Commission as a lobbyist probably covers everything we want to capture.
And I thought I understood it. So let me see if this is possible. Is it the case that the campaign the party who files as a campaign consultant can be either an individual or a corporate entity? So if I am employed by ABC firm, then ABC might file as a campaign consultant, and then its employees are treated in a certain way. But ABC might not be a campaign consultant. If I personally could file as a campaign consultant, then I think this language does make sense.
So you would be filing as a campaign consultant outside of your employment with ABC firm?
Or I'd be filing that I am a consultant, but the firm is not a consultant, and I will do all the filing for myself. Not personally, not independent of my work, but the other people in the organization are marketing people or lawyers or do campaign consulting in another state. And I am filing as a campaign consultant in San Francisco for a particular client or set of clients. If that is a possible scenario, then I think that makes this, that there are other employees in my organization who are not campaign consultants, and as long as I do everything that a campaign consultant needs to do, does it make my employer advertising agency a campaign consultant? I don't know whether, yes. So it hinges on that relationship between an individual as consultant and the company or partnership.
I don't know how you could be seen as working as an individual and be a part of a firm. That's how that's how you get the business. You know, I'm with XYZ firm, and we do. It's not like financial advisors who are independent, but they work under, umbrella of.
Well, I'm asking a question of staff about whether it's. Whether those scenarios are possible, whether you're right that a corporate entity partnership, whether the enterprise becomes a campaign consultant if anyone in it consults on a campaign as defined here. How have we understood that? Is that the same question?
Well, I can envision the rare case where there is a person working in some type of firm that's not a campaign consulting firm, mm-hmm. and is running someone's campaign. But I think for the most part, you find people who are running campaigns that are in a firm. That's what the firm does.
Well, why don't we hear from Ms.
I believe you're both right. But I do believe that your scenario is more of a hypothetical, and I do believe that Commissioner Ward's comments are more accurate, more reflective, and correct me if I'm wrong, Catherine, more reflective of what reality is. Most firms, if they are campaign consultant firms, that's what they do. And most individuals, if they are campaign consultants, they do it on an individual basis. And tell me about that.
I can think of one instance this year that someone was helping a friend, so he registered as an individual, but I don't, that wasn't his main job. He was just helping out somebody.
I'm not trying to torture us with a hypothetical, but I am trying to understand whether one person as a working, doing campaign consulting work makes their organization a campaign consultant. And I think you're right about running a campaign, but if you think about people who are consulting to a campaign on advertising or polling or something else that qualifies here, can't you be doing less than being the, who is managing the campaign? Maybe I'm forgetting the definition, and it has to be managing as opposed to managing an element of or consulting on. So if that's, now that I refresh my recollection of the definition, I'll step back because I think it's less likely. So was the group's suggestion that we take out the language that Commissioner Herr was referring to?
Maybe this goes back to the definition. I want to make sure that we're capturing both the individual consultant and the firm. I'm not recalling what some of the issues are now, but it seems like it's hard to track who's actually doing the consulting. So we can pull up the name, but we can't pull up the firm. I don't recall, but sometimes I've looked for one and sometimes I looked for the other and had a hard time putting it together. So as long as we capture both, that's what's important to me. And my just my last comment would be, as we're having this conversation, now I'm looking at this or any other employee of the campaign consultant's employer as I was seeing it internal to the firm, but now I think it could actually read as an employer is the client who hires the campaign consultant. And I don't think we want to open that possibility. We're not trying to regulate employees of the client.
I think if it meant client, it would say client and not employee.
I would hope, yeah.
I'm just going to say, so that we don't end up with a confused discussion, that I stepped back too quickly, I think. Campaign management is defined, but the term campaign consultant includes any individual or entity that provides campaign consulting services, not just manages campaigns. And there are definitions of both management, which is one element of that, and campaign consulting services, which includes participation in management or developing or participating in campaign strategy. And that does not limit it to people who are campaign managers. It is, as I've always understood it, to be people who are paid for consulting to campaigns on a variety of activities leading to the strategy, again, which could be marketing or outreach or field or organizing or advertising or policy even.
Just to clarify, when we talk about campaigns consultants, generally speaking, we're talking about the people who are actually making the top decisions, making the management decisions, making the strategic decisions. We're not talking about people who are just carrying out those decisions.
The other thing I'd like to say is,
but there can be more than one of them in a campaign.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is, I think raising the limit before which you have to register will alleviate some of this, because probably the person who's doing this as a side job, it may be the ones making less than the threshold. The other thing is, I'm not sure we're that interested, at least generally, in thinking about this sort of hypothetically, what could be out there in the person who's working at a job that's totally unrelated to political consulting and doing consulting on the side. I don't know that we need to know, that the public really needs to know what everyone in that other job is doing. I mean, if that person works for some big company, I feel like that may be really unduly onerous for the person who's helping out his friend to find out who everyone of his employer that's unrelated to political consulting is doing.
It would be onerous if we were asking them to report the activities of all those other employees. We're only asking them to identify if there's a registered lobbyist.
So, for example, what if he works for Intel? I mean, does he then need to go and find out every single person who's registered as a lobbyist?
In San Francisco, yeah.
In San Francisco?
Yeah, because if there's a consultant in San Francisco working with a lobbyist in San Francisco, this is a transparency issue. We'd like to know that they have that relationship. It's a, you know, Intel's probably got lobbyists all over the country. We only want the ones that are registered in San Francisco.
I guess I'm worried about the deterrent effect on the guy who's trying to help his friend, making, you know, not very much. That's a side job. You know, this is not part of his. I mean, obviously, if he's part of a consulting firm, he has to report. And I completely agree with Commissioner Hansen that those, we want to know everything about those entities. But to me, this seems remote enough. And even if it were to happen, the consequences of not reporting would be de minimis to me, and I think not something we'd want to legislate. And I also think the language is confusing for the reason Commissioner Hansen said. I mean,
I understand why you think it's confusing, but if that guy who's helping out his friend as a consultant just to be a good friend works with a professional lobbyist at work, that's still a relationship that we want on the record.
But this doesn't get to that. I mean, the person could have no relation at all to that.
If there are no lobbyists, where if the guy works at a gas station or at a law firm, if there's no lobbyists at the gas station or law firm, then we're not capturing anybody.
But this would capture that.
Yeah, if there was a lobbyist.
No, if the guy works at a gas station, this language, employee of the campaign consultant's employer, would require him to go and determine whether anybody at the gas station was also would have to, he'd have to declare that no one at the gas station was a lobbyist pursuant to the lobbying ordinance. And it just doesn't seem necessary to me that we require.
I see what you're saying. You could make it proactive that he only has to report if there is, doesn't have to report anything if there's not. But if it's not information you think we need, that's fine as well.
On the other hand, if we take it out for the gas station guy, then we take it out for everybody. And we do want to cover the firm's employees for the reason Director St. Croix said. We want to know the connections. We want to know the people doing this work.
I wonder if some of this kind of responsibility for people to find these things out, either now or in the future, becomes so much easier to find electronically that we don't have to make people go walk up and down the halls of, I'm picturing the university or the, you know, large enterprise that might have them. We may not be at the point where we can say just, you know, what's the cross match between the oil company and, or the gas station employee and the other and its lobbyist? And, you know, do they match up? If we think that that's where it's go, you know, where things are headed, where somebody who wants to know those overlaps can find them more simply than the burden that we put on people, where we want what we need from people who can. Who are the only ones who can provide it or in the best position to provide it. But, in fact, it might be more thorough to say, give me all the lobbyist and campaign consultant overlap, company overlaps. Do you have any thought about that, whether that's here or coming with our technology?
Ultimately, our intent with this would be, presuming this passes, is to convert registration to an electronic format like we did with the lobbyist thing. But before we start formatting that, we have to know what's right. going to be in the ordinance.
And would we be able to crosswalk from those two systems as far as you imagine? I mean, is that one of the capacities that we'd like our systems to have?
The capacity is there. I don't know what, if any, cost would be associated with it, which is sometimes a factor. But ultimately, we're hoping that once we can go like all electronic with everything, that there would be cross-reference through our entire database, lobbyist, consultant, campaigns, all of them.
So if I was a campaign consultant who qualified under the ordinance based on the $5,000 threshold, and I was employed by a organization that didn't have anything to do with campaign consulting, I'm not sure that I would feel obligated to reveal who my employer was, or if I was even employed. I mean, I'd identify myself as a campaign consultant working as an independent contractor on this. I don't know what my employment with Intel would have to do with any of this.
I'm sorry, are we?
Or with any, if I work for any organization that didn't have anything to do with campaign consulting, I don't know why I would be reporting that, revealing that.
Are we shifting gears a little bit here?
Not necessarily. Do we have, the person who did it as a favor for their friend, let's assume he works at a gas station for a minute. Do we have the legal right to ask him about where he works and the phone number and stuff like that if he doesn't not work for a consulting firm?
Under current law, if you can look at page 5, lines 10 to 11. If a campaign consultant is an individual, the campaign consultant must provide a name of the campaign consultant's employer and a description of the business activity engaged in by the employer.
Okay.
So that's under current law. If you're wanting to change that.
Nope.
So if we have that information already under lines 10 and 11, I guess I'm repeating myself. I guess I don't know why we then need to have them go identify every single lobbyist at Intel.
I'm actually inclined to agree with Commissioner Herr, if you wanted my 2 cents worth. And also Commissioner Ward.
And I've been back and forth on this one several times, and I certainly see the need to, because this particular provision is about the connectivity between campaign consultants and lobbyists. And I think that's an important connection. We're not simply looking for who the employees are of the campaign consultant firm. We're looking for the connection between a lobbyist and a consultant, which to me takes it to a whole nother level. So if the person is working even as one person for a firm, and there's a lobbyist in that firm, that's important information to have. So now I'm kind of back in the place.
Could you explain why that's important?
Well, because a lobbyist, you know, a campaign consultant can be advising a campaign, but if a lobbyist is then engaged in lobbying on the issue, as opposed to what the campaign consultant is doing, which is helping one person, then it, to me, that's why we have a separate lobbyist ordinance from campaign consultant ordinance. That's somebody, you know, setting up meetings with the Board of Supervisors and the mayor and pushing from the firm perspective or their individual perspective potentially the issue. So it broadens it and it takes it further in my mind in terms of the activity and the results that can occur. Rather than just advising a particular
person.
Except
the difference is that with a lobbyist, the lobbyist is lobbying an elected official or some other city employee, and that employee or official is going to decide whether or not he's going to render a favorable outcome for the lobbyist. In the case of a campaign consultant, he's trying to get somebody elected, and that's left up to the people. So I'm not sure that there is the kind of public interest that you're suggesting in terms of the connection.
Is this
because he's trying to get somebody elected, which is a difficult thing to do, unless he's starts walking around handing out $20 bills to voters.
Well, he is could it also the be other way. Go ahead.
Sorry, yep. I'll say quickly. He could also be, he or she could be working on a ballot measure, and that lends itself to lobbying quite easily.
In trying to understand why, what it would tell you, what we want to have be transparent, is this. Maybe this is the best explanation I can come to. It's that it's not that you care who the campaign, you want to know who the campaign consultant is just to know who they are and what they're getting. But this, it's really here because this is where we have the consultant, but we want to know the ability of the lobbyist to influence the person in his or her public decisions. And if I hire a campaign consultant and have some relationship with that organization and have demonstrated that I have some trust and at least a financial connection with somebody there, and somebody from that same organization lobbies me, will their lobbying have more power, carry more sway with me than another lobbyist would have? And it's not to tell, you're right, it has nothing to do with who chooses that person, makes the decision about the election. It's whether there's some extra power that the lobbyist has because you are paying somebody in that person's organization or have a relationship with somebody in the organization that might help the lobbyist get in the door,
okay,
or
so
better
that
reward the lobbyist.
So, say that that's
so it's
true.
Sort of in the, you know, it's here, but it really relates to
so
the
say
other
that
lobbyist.
That, true. So that's
yeah.
true.
Right.
So then what? What does it mean?
Because I think you'd already have the information. So, for example, in that situation, you'd know the consultant's employer because it's required under subsection 2, and the lobbyist would have to identify their employer, which would be the the same employer. And so you would know that you were being – that the politician was being lobbied by the same entity for whom they – hired a campaign consultant.
You're not saying that because they work in the same organization that either one of them is disqualified from doing what they do.
No.
Correct. No. So, and that's why I asked about the electronic. Both of those things might be on record. It's whether the burden of reporting it. I don't yet have a view on this section. It's simply whether the extra effort to do the crosswalk and tell us about them should be in the hands of the campaign consultant because there is some high level of interest, and as indicated by a voter passed initiative, or whether the members of the public or the press who want to know whether that's going on do that homework themselves. That's why I asked whether it might be electronically retrievable now or in the future, because yes, those things are both available and could be known, but you have to go through a number of either forms or files to find it.
I think that's true, but I do also think that the burden is going to be on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that we should place that burden on this, on the campaign consultant whose employer is, for whom he's not doing the campaign consulting work, because that, it increases the cost of that person being able to perform this work on the side for, a ballot measure. I mean, because it's going to be somebody or some organization that can't afford, obviously, the high-priced campaign consultant. And I'm worried that this places an undue burden on that person without providing us and the public with a corresponding equal benefit.
I wonder why the hypothetical of the friend doing this on the cheap for somebody creates one way of looking at it. My image, if I'm not making people crazy with alternate hypotheticals, is picture the largest, most powerful advertising agency, and somebody says, these ad agencies who work for candidates are really not doing the job. Look at some of the recent expenditures on advertising by candidates who didn't succeed, I'm going to try and find somebody different. I want to find the people who sell cars and beer. And I'm going to hire a person who doesn't usually do political campaign consulting, but for a huge amount of money. Do you want to know if those people are also doing lobbying, and do you feel differently about the burden?
But wouldn't that person be paid through their firm? I mean, I guess it's hard for me to imagine a situation where that person gets paid sort of on the side a huge sum of money to do a job. I mean, that's going to require a lot of time while they have this other job.
But that person, that's where I ask the you know, this may be more far-fetched than is worth regulating around, although sometimes it helps you see the what might happen or what will happen as this industry grows. If I'm at Smith & Jones, the major advertising agency, the decision might be that I, the individual, will file as a campaign consultant, but I still have to tell you who I work for, but that it is preferable for me to be a campaign consultant than for Smith & Jones, well-known national firm, to be listed as a campaign consultant, because that's not what they usually do. This may be unavailing, but I don't want to assume that it's always going to be a sympathetic little guy at the gas station in making policy that would also eliminate a responsibility on what might be a very different format of consultant.
I would concur. I think that's a useful example, and I don't think it's far-fetched. In terms of burden, I do think this ordinance serves the public, and I would default to the burden being more appropriately on the consultants and the lobbyists than the public. And this would, by linking these two, it certainly makes it easier for the public to get that information. We also know that lobbyists don't always register. So I don't think we can presume that we're going to get this information necessarily for lobbyists. One would hope, but certainly helps to have a way to cross-check.
You know, that raises an interesting question. We're asking somebody to determine not whether someone else in the organization is mm-hmm. registered, mm-hmm. but whether the person is required to register. That's
right.
I mean, how does that person find that information?
Mm-hmm. They can only find out yes. whether they're registered.
Well, the underlying language is the voter-passed initiative that we're dealing with, right? It's not ours to...
Right, but the underlying language didn't require you to look even at employees of the campaign consultant. It was just the campaign consultant itself. And so clearly that person should know whether he or she should be required to register. But, I mean, when you're extending it out to whether others are required, I just think this employee of campaign consultants' employers is too attenuated to meet the legislative purpose.
Is there any further discussion, or would someone like to make a motion?
I'll move to adopt decision point 5A, except that we strike the language employee of the campaign consultant's employer contained on line 15 of page 5.
So the sentence would read, a statement of whether the campaign consultant or any employee of the campaign consultant is required. Do I hear a second?
Second.
No public. Am I correct? The public has.
No public.
And here I thought this would be a hotly debated.
Should be.
I think it's December 13th, right? People are busy. Okay. We would take public comment, but there is no public in attendance. Is there any further discussion before I call the question? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No. And let me just add, I think it's complicated. I appreciate Commissioner Herr's comments and agree with some of them, and I just think this needs to be more thought out, so that's why I'm voting against it.
Item 5, decision point 5B1, which relates to timing of disclosures. Could I ask on this one, but also any of the others, whether if those of you who are involved with the interested party conversations could let us know if these were lively discussions, serious concerns, or
they were dead.
Even going from quarterly to monthly, didn't
nobody raise any objection? Nobody raised any comments regarding this.
Side coming. Huh?
Yeah,
I think there were people actually there.
There were individuals. The first one we canceled because we only got one response. But I talked to the woman before we canceled, and she said she wanted to attend just because she was interested very generally in the campaign consultant ordinance. She was a candidate for District 2 supervisor. And I told her about the upcoming ones, and she said she was ready to go on a cruise, so therefore she would not have any comments. I told her also to give us any comments in writing. And then the second, I can't remember, we scheduled four, I know we held three. The second one, I think, nobody attended. Nobody responded, nobody attended. The third and fourth one, two individuals attended. And they actually gave us some comments, some good comments. But for the most part, the people who, the second one, even though nobody attended, somebody came afterwards, and I met with him. And he was just very generally interested because he's running for mayor. In this upcoming election. But otherwise, he had no comments on the ordinance or any of the changes themselves. And then the third and fourth one, when we did have people actually come to the interested persons meetings, there were some good suggestions, and we incorporated some of them. But for the most part, they were not detailed discussions. It was just kind of general overall, what do you think? Should we keep this threshold? Do you have any comments on that? It was pretty much like that.
Can I just follow up in terms of, it sounds like it's not an extensive list, and I always like to see who comes to these meetings and then, you know, look at the comments that were incorporated from those particular folks. Were there, was there anyone in attendance who you would say would be someone on the interested persons list as opposed to someone from the regulated industry?
I don't think any consultants came at all.
No consultants came.
So more candidates, previous candidates, treasurers?
More candidates.
Candidates.
And interested persons than anything else.
Uh-huh. And the interested persons were people you describe who just were kind of generally interested in the ordinance? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. So comments or questions on the changes in decision point 5B1?
I was wondering how much it would cost, what the cost increase is for administering it if it has to be done on a monthly basis.
Ultimately, if we put this into an electronic filing format like we do with the lobbyists, it's actually less of a cost because the moment those reports are submitted, the information is available in the system. So the way it is now, the staff takes all the filings in and composes a report. So it would actually automate that process. I started to talk about this before. We are not going to format the electronic process before the measure passes, because if it doesn't, there's no point. And if it does, then we'll know what format to do. So there may be an interim period where we sort of do things the old-fashioned way until we get the software up and running. But I anticipate that the development of the software will be relatively easy and inexpensive because it's going to pretty much mirror the lobbyist filing. And it's not going to be exactly because there's different information, but it would be along those lines.
So once that's in place, it's pretty much going to cost the same whether you require it every month or every quarter.
And it seems like it's becoming our standard reporting requirement.
I would say. I mean, the things that we do for us, you know, they're either annually or quarterly, and we're moving monthly. Mm-hmm. The things that the state enforces, we have no control over those.
Right.
So.
Right.
Okay. Would anybody like to make a motion on this one?
I'll make a motion that we approve decision point 5B1.
Thank you. There's no public, so no public comment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you very much. 5B2. Discussion?
I will just say, in general, there are a lot of deletions, and I don't know the best way to do this, but I'm concerned about some of those deletions, and I don't know if we want to go through those individually, but as it is, I can't support it because there's so many pieces to this one.
Actually, the memo will talk about deletions starting on page 8, and so perhaps we can.
Yeah, I think at the moment we're talking about 5B2, which is just the, am I right, the date client retained and terminated? We're on page 6 of the
5B2.
Memo.
Yeah.
And page 6 of the draft ordinance from lines 1 to 7.
It's above, mm-hmm. the content is above.
Right.
It just, the decision point follows the discussion, so it's online.
Right, but.
Oh, okay. You're looking at the paragraph. Language would no longer be necessary.
Right.
Got
and
it.
If you go
so
through,
it's the deletions that follow from it if we approve
exactly.
those two things.
Yeah.
Thank you. I apologize. The staff has proposed to delete. So, Mabel, what were you pointing us to regarding the deletions?
The language that we're looking at now is at the top of page 6, lines 1 to 7.
Page 6 of the ordinance.
Of the ordinance.
I'm sorry, page 6, line 1 to page 7, line 11.
Oh, sorry.
So we do we do have some deletions on page 7 dealing with political contributions, but we do require them to provide information about the contributions, and that's back on page 6. Mm-hmm. What we do is delete information about gifts, and I think that actually is a decision point. So maybe, yeah, that actually is a decision point, so my reference in decision 5B2 is incorrect. It should end at line 5. No, it should be in.
Including 6 and 7.
Where am I? Right.
Sure, I'm sorry. So basically, this decision point 5B2, covering page 6, line 1 through page 7, line 11, would detail the content of the monthly disclosures. Mm-hmm. Now, in there, there's a couple of deletions, which Commissioner Hansen noted. And the first one that Mabel talked about already is on page 7, lines 1 through 5, which talks about contributions, which are separately addressed in some of the new language on the preceding page. And there's a separate gift provision that the staff has recommended deletion of on page 7, lines 6 through 7, which is separately addressed in decision point 5F. Hopefully that helps. So.
So in other words, decision mm-hmm. point 5B2 really sets for what is required to be disclosed. If the commission at a later time wishes to undelete any gifts promised, they can certainly do that. Okay?
Would it be accurate to say in decision in the box that sets forth 5B2 that it's page 6, line 1 to page 7, line 5 because... at least 6 and 7, or at least to take out 6 and 7 if they're in 5F?
Yeah, that's another way of doing it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, deleting So line 6 and 7 on page 7 are not part, you can make this not part of this decision point, because you're going to get to this at a later point in 5F, right? So you can say, as set forth in section 1.515B on page 6, line 1, to page 7, line 5, and page 7, lines 8 to 11.
And that helps me. I would also say that the bulk of the deletions actually come under, I think, decision point 5D. So we continue.
Let's go through them one at a time, I think, if we could.
But do you want to stay on 5B2 first and just take those? Because I'm actually moving to the next page where all the deletions start, and that's not part of this decision point.
Right. So we would, you're
so
comfortable with
that.
I think you're both saying the same thing. You're both happy with addressing 5B2. Which changes the date. Well, we can all read it. So we have before us 5B2.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
One of the deletions is this page 7, line 1 through 5, taking out the cumulative total. Just would like some more information about why we would not ask for that.
You're generally asking for a report of any political contribution of $100 or more. So you can add up what is, what has been reported. And the other thing is that political campaign contributions are reported on campaign finance reports by, the committees that receive them. So actually this is duplicative reporting already. But because this is something that was in the ordinance, we didn't feel like we should take it out.
So it's duplicative both in terms of the cumulative, because we can just add that up, and it's duplicative in terms of the other language, in terms of
made by the client at
behest.
Yes. That is on page 6, lines beginning line 12, 13.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments on that item? There are no members of the public here at the meeting. Is there a motion on 5B2?
I move that we adopt decision point 5B2.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. 5C.
Five D.
Oh, right, 5C was a little one. 5D. Okay, let's dive in here. Are there any questions about 5D?
Many.
Anyone? I'll start. Could you give us an idea how these fees compare to the lobbyist registration fees? Sorry, I didn't mean that to be a trick question, a hard one.
Oh, they're 500, right? Lobbyists are. I think they're the same. Except the lobbyists, the threshold is $1,000 in every, if you make $1,000 in a 3-month period, you can qualify as a lobbyist. And the fee is $500
regardless
per lobbyist.
Of size.
Yes.
Okay.
How much does it cost to administer the ordinance now?
The campaign consultant ordinance?
Yes.
You had that someplace. It's right there.
It's about $20,000, give or take.
So we think it's going to cost about $13,500 more to administer the new one?
The estimate is $13,500, yeah.
What, can you break that down a little more?
In terms of
what is costing the $13,500? What parts of the ordinance are costing the $13,500?
The creating electronic filing system.
So that's a one-time?
Well, it's a one-time. I mean, they have to create it. They have to maintain it. It's the entire thing. It's the creation as well as the maintenance fees. It's just like the lobbyist ordinance. We have to pay Netfile a certain amount of money each year so that they administer, continue to maintain the campaign finance information that comes in. So it would be pretty much similar with the campaign consultant ordinance. And same thing with the lobbyist ordinance. There's a kind of like a maintenance fee. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that answered. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think my concern is that it still feels onerous for the person earning $5,000 to pay 10% of that as a consulting fee. So I think I'd be in favor of a sort of graded approach like we had before. And if we have to increase those numbers a little bit to meet the shortfall caused by what I think I think we have a huge public interest in having it electronically, so I think that's probably a worthwhile cost. But I don't know that I feel like it'd be disproportionately borne by those who were earning $5,000 or somewhere in that range.
My recollection at the time that we changed the lobbyist fees was that we were reducing them. And so weren't we?
We did reduce them, but the Board of Supervisors bucked them back up to $500.
Thank you. That explains why that process seemed different. And I share Commissioner Herr's concern about a 10% fee on $5,000 and very different effect on the larger either organization or person charging much more. And it seems that that's not the direction we want to go in. You're right. We had a $200 lobbyist amount, didn't we, when we passed it? It was a reduction from what it had been.
Right.
I thought that initially, too. Mm-hmm. The $5,000, the $500, it's 10%. But how many campaign consultants are at the $5,000 level? Seems to me that those are the part-time consultants. They're not really, they're making a little extra. This is not how they're making their living. You know, if they're making $5,000, this is not how they're making their living. And so I'm not sure that it's the kind of burden that it seems to pay $500 to be, certified to do this type of work.
I guess I would argue that the burden is actually greater because someone who's not doing this as their job and is doing this after hours, you're increasing the barrier to entry for those people. I mean, they're less likely to do the work if they know that 10% of, the amount they're making that they're working on, between 6 p.m. and midnight is going for this fee. And I think it would be more fair to maybe you raise the amount over for those over $20,000 to $500 and raise the amount for those below to $300 or something to make up the shortfall. But I guess I just don't think it's fair that the people making $5,000 are paying that much.
We actually have a relatively simple number. Those who earn between $5 and $20 right now pay $200. So
right.
We could either leave it there, move to 250 or 300 for them and increase the 20,000 and above.
But is this common in, is this common in the fee structure in city government that there are graduated fees based on
real estate transactions? Yes, many of them are graded by the scale of the transaction.
Most, aren't they? I think in San Francisco, most fee structures are static for licenses and fees and that sort of thing. I think there's probably, in city programs, there are probably some exceptions for people living below the poverty level or something like that. There might be some assistance available.
But generally, everybody pays the same
yeah.
fee
yeah.
for something.
Something like building permits is graduated, so it's a portion of your the yeah. estimated job that you would then have to pay to get the permit to do the job.
Right, or transfer and recordation fees. A number of them are scaled to the size of the project or the size of the transaction. Some are not.
Sorry, go ahead. I just have a suggestion, and it's not in here, but we actually debated, staff initially debated whether or not we should define a campaign consultant as somebody who earns $10,000 or more in 12 months, but we went down to 5 after the interested persons meeting. What we may want to do is individuals, we would require anybody who earns $5,000 or more as a campaign consultant to register as a campaign consultant, but only those who pay, who earn at least $10,000 will pay the fee. And that's most, if not, no, most except for a handful of folks. So the folks who earn between 5 and 10 would be not subject to a fee. I mean, that's just something I'm throwing out there.
This year so far, out of the 47 that were registered, 29 have earned over 10,000.
How many have earned over 20,000?
I don't know.
Sorry. But the time for registration, I mean, the time to file.
Right, there's a filing deadline on Wednesday, and that's why the numbers aren't 100%.
It's 29 out of, did you say 47 earlier?
Does that not include the 3?
That does not
include.
I mean, the 3 are included in the 47.
Right. So there's 15 consultants registered now that make between 5 and 10,000.
Well, a lot of those registered after the last reporting deadline. So we either don't know anything because they were only active from September 1 on, or in the previous reporting period, they earned less than $10,000
in the
reporting period.
So the number could go up.
Definitely.
And is likely to go up.
Definitely, yes.
I have a question about the deletion of the client fee. What led to that decision to take that out?
There's no client fee in the lobbyist ordinance, and we basically track that. And we just couldn't understand why there would be a client fee. Staff was just, we just couldn't understand why there is a client fee for having clients. And that's all.
I mean, I guess one reason is when someone has a lot of clients, then it seems appropriate for them to pay more to me than if they have one client, which sort of goes to the sliding scale discussion as well. I think the, connecting these two, I feel like I was supporting the sliding scale if we were going to keep it at 1,000. I do think 500, I know it's simple, that would be, it seems like that's more the standard in the cities to have a fee, have one fee. And 500 does seem a bit onerous to me to someone making 5,000. In the same token, the 200 fee for those between 5 and 20 seems incredibly low. So I think we can raise the higher if we're going to do a sliding scale. But one way to get to that, rather than a sliding scale, is to keep the client fee so that we capture at a higher level the people who are, you know, the bigger firms with more clients.
Based on the numbers that we just heard, it doesn't sound like we're going to lose much in the way of revenue if we took Zing's suggestion of raising the threshold to $10,000, because there are not that many people below. So we're not going to lose that much. And is $500 at $10,000, the $10,000 earning, does that feel more comfortable for everybody?
To me, yes. I would also say that I think everybody should pay a fee, something. You know? So below $10,000, what would that be? For those below 5,000 or 10,000?
Below whatever number we agree on, 10,000, mm-hmm. You know, make it $100. You're not going to get that much, but you're not going to lose that much either.
Are these cumulative amounts that they earn from multiple clients, or is this per client?
No, it's cumulative from. Okay. Yeah, multiple clients. And my understanding is that client fees don't raise that much money. It's $50 per client. Even if you had a 100 clients, which you don't have, maybe if you had 20 clients, which I think is what could be average, it doesn't raise that much money. 20 times is what, $1,000? Is that what it is? Yeah, okay. So it's not going to make a big difference if we retain client fees, but on the other hand, it's a little bit, it may add to administration. Then again.
Yeah. And more chances for gotcha that you didn't yes. calculate it right, or you did, you know, the client, somebody had the whole year or half a year, two clients, you know, client equivalents. It seems like a nuisance to not much end.
Even if we go to that split with 100 or 500, that's still a simplification over what we have now. So we would be in favor of that.
Yeah, that sounds, what Commissioner Warden Hansen said, yeah. Seems to make sense to me.
I'd have picked 200 and 500, but I will go with the majority.
I was just going to suggest, instead of looking at 10% of 5,000, what if we went with 5% and looking at all three of these levels? That would be... for those 20,000 above, it'd be 1,000. For 10,000, it would be 500. And then for those 5 to 10, picking the lower figure of 5,000, it would be 250. So it'd be 250, 5, and 1,000. 1,000's only for those 20,000 and above. But using a standard like a percentage.
My only hesitation is that it's so much higher than lobbyists, and in my own mind, I can't think of a justification for.
But lobbyists' fees are higher. Lobbyists have to, the threshold is certainly different
for
lobbyists.
Right, I'm picturing a $20,000, the high end for both, you would be registering as a lobbyist for much less than a campaign consultant registration. So I don't see a philosophical distinction between mm-hmm. what the registration should be by the type of work. It's really, we've been talking about a fee for paying for the system that allows us to deliver the information that the public says they want.
Understandable. Yeah. I think we're trying to track the lobbyist ordinance in some cases, but certainly not mm-hmm. in others. So when you have a threshold where you can only make $1,000 in 3 months and have a much, and then you have to report. It's a much different standard than we're mm-hmm. asking for consultants.
But don't you think people would be a bit taken back by, you know, you raise a fee from $200 to $1,000?
Yeah.
I had
400. It'd be
400 is the current. But they also have to pay client fees, and we're taking those out. So that's going to reduce their cost. But for 20,000 and above, it's 400 that would go up to 1,000.
I had thought about a 5% fee as a way to, again, keep it as simple as possible. Problem with that is you're inviting the creation of loopholes, from my perspective, in that I think that especially the top billing consultants will find ways to bill their clients for something separately from consulting services to get around the fee, and that means we have a whole new bunch of things to police. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think it could.
But you're not making it 5% thereafter.
Don't you think in fairness that it ought to have some relationship to the cost of administering the? I mean, if we can raise the money for administering the program through the setting of a reasonable fee structure, isn't that what we want to do? Not just kind of stick it to people who are making a little bit of money.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question about client fees, just to follow up? Do we have any information on how much we bring in from client fees? So what, in reality, what would this look like for consultants who are now having to pay X amount because it includes client fees, and if we take those out, what would it go down to?
Generally, most consultants have one or maybe two clients. There are a couple big firms that will have, over the course of a year, maybe eight, you know, some in June. But typically those are making well over $100,000 a quarter. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Hurd, to answer your question, I just did a quick review of the last quarterly report, and there are 17 consultants that have earned over $20,000 this year. And that number could go up.
I was feeling Solomonic here.
Based on everything I've heard, I think it maybe might make sense to leave the $200 number for those below 10,000 and then have that flat $500 fee for everyone above.
How would people feel?
I'd like to see it higher, on the higher end. 500 for those making 20,000 above, that's pretty small.
I don't have a problem with it at the 20. I would only be interested in a higher amount if we had a third step for a very high one, and I think that starts to be as much hassle for the staff, or starts to become look like a revenue source as opposed to a system maintenance cost.
I just feel like, you know, a fee is a fee. I mean, I don't think we have any business taxing people. You know, this seems like we want to, what you're suggesting, Commissioner Hansen, feels like you want to tax people based on what they're earning. And I don't see that as our role.
Do commissioners generally feel okay about dropping the client fee?
I do. I'll step out. I do, in large part because the staff feels that it's a nuisance, and I think it has potential for being more confusing without being helpful. There are as many small people who, you know, the lower dollar people may have multiple clients, and then their fees start to go up as much as the large people. Yeah. If eight is a lot of clients, that seems not worth a lot of headache to collect.
I agree with that.
just want to make a final point that we are even if we keep the 200, or because we might keep the 200, we are dropping the client fee. So
it's actually going down.
So it'll go down. You know, the revenue that we will be bringing in and what we are asking consultants to do will go down in every case, including raising the 400 to 500. So we're going to be bringing in less revenue.
Because the 5,000 person would have been paying $200 and at least $50
exactly.
for a client because they had
it. Right, but the $10,000 person is paying $500 instead of $200.
There's a window there that's...
Yes.
And most of the people, and there are a lot of people between 10 and 20.
Category.
Most
I'm sorry.
Of the people are going to be paying $500 now.
Right. So for some people, it's going up. And I haven't done the math, but so I don't know what the end result is. So maybe we don't lose revenue. Seems to me on the surface we do, but maybe not.
I don't see how we can.
Because so many people go up at the lower level.
I mean, if it's worth maybe having the staff do the run the numbers on what we've just talked about, maybe because, I mean, I don't know how hard that is to do or...
Not losing anything.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like we'd be losing anything.
There's
because
no
fewer because people.
If everybody is still paying what they were paying at below, and everybody above is paying more, there's no way to lose money.
Right.
But add up the client fees. So if everyone has at least one client, so we've got 47 clients at least at $50, and some have 8, and some have 2 and 4.
Still peanuts.
I mean, 50 is low, but, you know, in the aggregate, it's could be significant.
Well, there's no way to, I guess the only way to know that is to know how many client fees they're going to be in the future.
There would be none, because we're taking them out.
No, but in order to determine what the loss is, because the number of clients don't remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
For consultants.
But in the same way that we got the numbers on the consultants and what they're making, we could look at the last year and see what we brought in.
Well,
I just did a quick rundown, and we're losing $4,700 in revenue from client fees, assuming that each consultant has two clients. That's $100 each. We're gaining $14,500 in revenue from the increased fees. So it's a net gain of about $10,000. It's not going to be quite that high because I'm only assuming two clients per consultant. But that's a ballpark.
Thank you for that. Obviously, I needed to do my math.
So I'm sorry. And thank you, Mr. St. Croix, for those numbers. How does that compare to, and maybe you have it here and I'm missing it, what we would generate under the proposal that the staff made? It looks like you're saying we'll generate $22,500, but that sounds like a total, not the in addition to what
we're
generating
now. Well, it would reduce the staff proposal. Is higher because everybody pays the $500. So I didn't include in my math the income from the people paying the lower fee, only the people I knew paying the higher one.
But it's probably not going to be much because very few people you guys said made.
No, the proposal that I think you guys are looking at, the $100-$500, would be slightly less than what the staff proposal is. Because there'd be a handful of people paying 100 instead of 500.
200.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
But the last suggestion would have 200 up to 10,000 and 500 thereafter, 500, 10 and above.
Right.
Is there a motion to that effect, or do you want to continue the discussion?
So we would just
I'm
be going
so
on this
I'm not so good at making
one.
Motions. I'm good at second motions that I agree okay. with.
We're not accepting decision point 5D in total, just this one portion of it, or does this cover everything in D 5D? I think there are other.
No, I think the other pieces are in the next. Okay, you're going by the lines and I'm going by the chunks. So,
because 5D covers page 7, line 17, where we are now, but then also right. goes to page 8, line 9.
I thought it was.
But
the same.
I think it's,
yeah,
all,
it's all
fees.
The rest of it. Yeah.
So I think we're okay.
Right. Okay.
Okay. I'll make a motion that we adopt decision point 5D. With the exception that those campaign consultants who earn less than $10,000 per year pay a registration fee of $200, and those campaign consultants who make more than $10,000 per year pay an annual fee of $500.
Could I clarify? You said under and over.
More.
You mean
right.
10,000 and under?
10,000, yeah. That, maybe
or
I should
under
redo
10
that.
And 10 and 10 or more. Do you have a
Let's
preference?
Just, yeah.
How do you like to do these?
At the 10 or less.
Okay.
10 or less. Okay.
Is 200. Over 10 is 500.
Did I start over?
No.
Or is
no,
that clear?
I think
okay.
we've got that.
For a second. Second that emotion.
There, no public. All in favor, please say aye.
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 And those that make 10,001 are?
I suggest that we take a short break at this point of the 5-minute variety, during which time I will ask people their taste for soldiering on past 8 o'clock or not. Or we can judge at 8 how far we are and how close we are to getting done. Does that seem reasonable? So let's take a 5-minute break. We are returning now. I'm trying to figure out my place. I've got proposed deletions circled, but that was a separate category from major substantive, which was 6, 8, 9,
six.
Right? 6, 8, 9, and 16. And then we'll come back to the deletions. Okay? Because there were so many of them, but they were so interesting. Let's look at decision point 6, which appears on page 10 and relates to section 1.520, relating to perjury. Any discussion or question? Any questions or discussion on this one? It also, I should add, clarifies record-keeping requirements, proposes to add a new paragraph related to random audits, and gives the commission subpoena authority. Does this, is this also one that provides comparability with the lobbyist provisions?
Pretty much so, yes.
I would make a motion to approve decision point 6.
I would second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Decision point 8 on page 11, section 1.530.
I would make a motion to approve decision point 8.
I'll second.
I had some questions about this one.
Okay.
My question was related to the sentence that begins thereafter on line 21 of page 11. Thereafter, campaign consultants shall have complete additional training sessions as required by the executive director at his or her Does that mean that some consultants can be required to go under more training than others? Or would this apply to all consultants?
This would apply to all consultants. This actually tracks language in the lobbyist ordinance. And I believe the reason we have this is not to require them to have yearly training, but to require them to have training as necessary if there are changes to the ordinance.
I And I wonder if that sort of language would be better. I mean, what my concern, and you alleviated if that was the purpose, but that it can be read that the executive director could require one consultant to undergo training every week and or more often, right. And others to not go through it at all.
So the language might be something like, thereafter, the executive director, in his or her discretion, may require campaign consultants or all campaign consultants to complete additional training. Or campaign consultants shall.
If other people thought it was ambiguous, I mean, maybe I was just reading it too broadly.
What Mabel said is the main reason for this, but it could be too that this is 60 days after initial registration. So it may be that there's a group of consultants that have gone 5 years without a training, and we may decide that it's time for a new one. So this would allow us to also do something like this. If you haven't had a training in X number of years, then you need to come to the next one we're having, something like that.
So in that case, it would separate out a subset,
yeah,
who needed training, per your judgment.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't ask you to trust every executive director in perpetuity, not to pick on consultants, but I can't imagine that I would do that. But
sure, and of course, this is right. I mean, exactly. The point is that it's not directed towards you, but just in general, sort of the that we create a system that didn't permit abuse of discretion as much as we can avoid it.
What if you had just added a sentence that said the executive director shall report any additional training required to the commission, something like that, to make sure the commission has a notification to conduct oversight so that that doesn't happen?
I think that's a good idea.
It works. Okay. Any other questions or comments? No public to comment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 So the motion was to approve the decision point, but it should be now to the motion to approve
as amended. You're right.
Yeah.
To include Mr. Sinkreis.
Yes.
Suggested addition. Thank you. Decision point 9 relating to our powers and duties. Questions or comments, please.
I'll make a motion to approve decision point 9 as written.
I'll second.
Any discussion? No public. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Only other item identified as a substantive or major substantive item is decision point 16, appearing in the memo on page 13, with respect to the operative date for these amendments.
I would make a motion to approve decision point 16 as written.
No public. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Now let's go back to the item involving the proposed deletions, because there were some there with substance, and then we will clean up the rest of the group. Why don't we take them all as a group, though? Are there... Let's do it.
What point are we talking about?
It's 5F on. So F through L, I believe. We're starting on page 8 where it says proposed deletions, and the first one is gifts. You know, let's do them one at a time because otherwise we'll be jumping around. We're on decision point 5F. Can
Can I just ask on five, let me see, I just want to identify all these deletions. Are there not deletions related to 5C? That's 14 to 16, which we took out of the other discussion. Page 7, lines 14 to 16, related to sorry, is that what we took out? I think
no, we took out 6 through 7, or not 5, 16, R5F, okay. Which we're doing now.
16 and, let's see, so 14 to 16.
14 to 16 are additions, not
right.
Deletions.
So 5C is okay. Then 5D, we covered. And 5F is gifts. Okay.
Right. So we'll come back to the ones that begin on line 22. So, gifts.
Thank you.
Could somebody simply state this in the affirmative? A consultant may do the following, or it just, I was going back and forth trying to put this in context with the other provisions you were referring to.
You're asking about what current law is? Under state law and local law, the general rule on gifts is that you can receive up to $420 worth of gifts from a single source. Now, if you are a restricted source under local law, that is a person who has contacted your department to influence a legislative or administrative action, or if you have a contract with your department, you may not provide any gifts. This generally does not apply to campaign consultants. Generally speaking, you don't have contracts with departments, and nor are they lobbyists who seek to influence a city officer in decision-making. So generally speaking, they don't have the restricted gift rule does not apply, and so they may give gifts, that's generally, they may give gifts up to $420 to any person who files the SEI. Under current law, a campaign consultant who gives a gift to any local office holder or local city officer during the reporting period, that is the last 3 months, that aggregates to $50, must report that. And what we're proposing is to delete this because there's really no prohibition under state law against a campaign consultant from giving a local office holder who, if the campaign consultant is not a restricted source, from giving a gift that's worth less than $420 or less. So this is really just recognizing that they have the ability to give gifts to office holders. And office holders, on the other hand, will have to report any gifts that they receive that's worth $50 or more. So it's already being reported by the office holder, but it's even though it's not until once a year. So what we wanted to do was just eliminate this because we didn't think that it accomplished anything. That
so, in your view, the effect is to have a second report, in this case from the giver, that's a duplicate for these gifts of the one of the report that will be made by the candidate.
By the city officer.
By the office holder.
Now, the thing is that since implementation of the ordinance, there have only been two gifts that have ever been reported. And I think both of them were by one campaign consultant. One was for a $19 box of candy and one for a $45 luncheon. Otherwise, campaign consultants don't give gifts to, generally, do not give gifts to office holders.
But maybe because of the requirement. Why would it have to be reported later?
Why were those reported if they didn't aggregate to $50 or more?
Sometimes campaign consultants like to err on the side of transparency and disclosure. Sometimes they register even though they don't qualify as campaign consultants, and sometimes they report everything just to make sure they're not in trouble.
Good practice.
Does anybody have questions or comments around this?
I would be in favor of retaining, or let me start a different way. In terms of lobbyists, we do not allow any gifts. Correct?
It's the same, let me see, lobbyists? Yes, because it's different sources. Because they are restricted sources.
Right.
And so that's why you cannot give a gift. I mean, there are the minimus exceptions to the restricted gift rule. But those lobbyists really are people who are trying to influence legislative or administrative action. Campaign consultants, on the other hand, are people who are trying to win elections. They're not there to influence legislative or administrative action.
Or they're trying to get business, which is not the subject so much of these. Hire me instead of Commissioner Hurd, advise your campaign.
Right. Understandable, and I think there is a difference. Again, in just sort of the message to the public, I'm not sure that I see any reason to allow any gifts. It certainly doesn't seem like it's abused. It doesn't seem like gifts are standard, but I don't know why we would allow them at all.
The thing is that there's no prohibition on them receiving a gift.
Right.
The law is that they can receive gifts up to $420.
Yes.
They must disclose those that are worth $50
or more. Right.
I mean, unless we adopt a rule to say that campaign consultants may not give gifts, there's really no prohibition.
To say.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. It's the giving that we're looking at, not the getting.
This is something that if the commission adopts the repeal rules, you can do. Never mind.
I suppose for me, part of it is just there's, I want the public to have easy access to whatever it's entitled to know by whatever standard it has set by law, but I don't want to clog it up with a lot of extra reports and bits and pieces floating around that distract from, you have said restricted sources cannot give, and you want to know who gets certain kinds of things. And if there are just all stray reports that don't follow those, I fear that it could be fall more in a confusion zone than understanding is good, knowledge is good, follow everything, because there's already a lot rolling around. And I want to feel confident when we say to a regulated player, you must do this, that there's a good reason for it, so that when we say, you really have to do those things, you really have to do, but we're going to cut out the ones that we have to try and imagine why they existed. So, and I think that's partly following your, there are things we really want to be able to be very, and enforcement effort and paper flow. Is there any further discussion of 5F? Do I hear a motion? The motion maker.
I move that we adopt decision point 5F.
Second.
There's no public here. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
5G. This is the re-registration requirement. Are there any questions or discussion? Do I hear a motion?
I'll make a motion that we adopt decision point 5G as written.
Second.
No public with us to comment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. 5H.
I had a question about deleting the client authorization. Just looking for more information. Not seen as necessary, onerous.
I believe that under current law, you're asking about client authorization. Mm-hmm. It's the client that has to sign a form to say I hired this person, campaign consultant, on such and such a date, effective such and such a date. That is something that is signed by the campaign consultant. What we envision with online filing with by campaign consultants is to get rid of all required paperwork, and we just didn't see a way of requiring campaign consultants' clients to also get into the system to say, yeah, I hereby authorize so and so. Most campaign consultants, if not all, I believe, do not lie about who is their client, or we've not encountered that issue.
And I guess that was my question. What is the purpose? Why do we need to verify that someone has these clients? Has there been any history of people inflating their client list, or certainly underreporting, I would think, would be more of a concern, but why would we need a client to say, yes, this person hired me? Not a problem in the past. Okay.
So the question, were you satisfied with that answer?
Yeah.
We don't need, okay. Is there a motion on 5H?
I'll make a motion to adopt 5H as written.
Second.
No public, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. 5I, economic consideration from vendors.
I had a question. I'm not sure what I think about deleting this one, and it seems like the rationale for deleting is that it's confusing, and I wonder if it might be better to clarify the language as opposed to deleting it, if that's really the problem. I do understand the difference in economic consideration and that confusion, but it certainly seems to me that thanks. there's an interest that relates to vendors and sub-vendors. I'm not sure. I just want to take that out. So, is that? I guess it's a question about can we make this clearer, or is the thinking of staff that it's really the confusion makes it just inappropriate?
Staff has been very confused by this. We're not sure what it means. If we're not sure, I don't think we can give advice on what it means, because we really don't know.
Do we think there's an important rationale here? Is it that we want to know how much a campaign consultant is making from a particular campaign? Because if that's it, the fact that only six consultants have ever reported could mean they're confused, or they're ignoring it, or that the requirement keeps vendors from giving them anything in this form, or them from asking vendors for anything, in which case it keeps us getting a relatively clear picture of what the campaign consultant compensation is. But I'm not sure whether that's the public interest. In the first place.
Well, isn't this a provision that gets at the limits set for contribution to candidates? Isn't that what it is? If I'm a printer and I want to support a candidate above the level that, you know, what is it, $500?
Yeah.
So if I want to provide services beyond my $500 limit, this is the way I do it.
You underwrite the campaign manager
fee. That's the way I do it.
And we know that there are instances of vendors like printers not submitting a final invoice so that they're giving benefit to a campaign. The campaign reports, it's not clear that they spent this much money because they didn't. And there's definitely a relationship between vendors and campaigns that has been problematic, and we don't really have a good way of dealing with that. This is maybe one way to deal with it. Excuse me.
And actually, I understand Ms. Ng's point about the staff not being able to provide advice on provisions that they don't understand. But from my standpoint, that's the very reason that I wouldn't change it if I didn't understand it, because there may be we may just be missing something, and
fair enough. Yeah, go ahead.
Quickly, out of the six consultants that reported anything under this section, I can't speak for all of them, but at least two of them reported every sub-vendor payment, basically, that they had made on behalf of the committee that they were reimbursed for, which is something that it doesn't seem that this is what it's asking for. So they believe that we're asking for that information, and that's what was provided.
I'm hearing some uncertainty about this one and some sense that I'm not sure we want to tackle it, but does someone want to make a motion, or would you prefer that we sort out the clarity another way?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
If we do retain this, perhaps the commission can consider adopting some regulations to clarify what this means at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Makes sense.
Yes. Exactly.
A lot of us weren't around when the campaign consultant ordinance was adopted, and it wasn't done at the behest of the Ethics Commission. So we don't have any original records or anything to explain why things were done, which is why we're not, you know, hanging our heads in shame that we don't know these answers. But of course, we'll have these records for whoever does it next time.
I think that's fine. Are people comfortable with that? Okay. Let's move on to J. Anyone?
I think on this one, it would be useful to know whether a city officer, for example, was being employed by a consultant to promote a ballot measure or something like that. Because I think the public would want to know whether they were being paid to have a position or whether they were having that position because of their own views, you know, based on what their experience in office.
I would agree.
Is there anything else that you suggest we know about this, given those concerns?
Just responding to Commissioner Hurst's point, the office holder would be required to report any source of income over $500 on an annual report. There's always the possibility that an office holder wouldn't properly report, certainly some of those things on a Form 700. But it's certainly possible that they wouldn't want to comply with this disclosure requirement either.
I think
what's
the problem
the
is, though,
the,
yeah, I mean, yeah. That report comes out like
every April 1.
April 1, right?
Right.
And so the election would already be over. The voters would have decided, and they would have only found out later.
When would this have to?
Right. Wouldn't this have to be reported along with all the other monthly reporting?
Yes.
I think the voters would want to know that at the time they were making their decision. Because it's not illegal, so I mean so the office holder would report in April, it would be no problem. They would face no flack for that, and they shouldn't. But I think the public in making their decision would want to know
at the time or near around the time of the election that this individual is being paid.
Any further thoughts? Does the staff have any concerns or additional ideas?
I actually miss what Commissioner Hurst said as to why there's an interest in this.
So, for example, if a city officer is being paid to be a consultant on the side and they're supporting a ballot measure for which they're a consultant and that's not disclosed or the amount, right, then I think the public would want to know that because they'd want to know whether that city officer was making that, was endorsing that measure because he's being paid as a consultant or because he believes that based on his experience in office.
Measure or another candidate.
Or another candidate or anything. That was just an example. Right? Is there?
Yeah. No. Okay. I'll just stay true to form. Does anybody want to make a motion on this item? I'm sensing not, but okay. Then we're on 5K. So is this requirement, this would delete the requirement that campaign consultants disclose in their now monthly reports each or any city contract obtained by the campaign consultant if the contract is approved by the local office holder who is a client. Any questions or discussion?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I would again say there's a public interest in knowing this information, even if it is unlikely and reported elsewhere. I think it belongs here.
Any other questions or comments? Does anybody want to make a motion?
I agree with Commissioner Hanson.
So do I.
I do too.
Okay. We're going to pass on the opportunity offered to us by decision point 5K. 5L.
Similarly.
I once again agree.
So do I.
Me too.
Okay. We're going to move on past 5L. We've done decision point 6. And the remaining ones are the ones that were described as small technical and I, including, would it be helpful to summarize what they are? Maybe somebody else could do it, but
3B, 3C, 3D.
3B, 3C. You were waiting for this
moment. 3B. 3C, 3D, 5C, 5E, 7, and 10 through 15.
Okay, why don't we take a second and check through them and see if there's anything that we have questions or concerns about. It's almost 8 o'clock. We have, let's put all the questions we have, if any, about those items on the table, and then we'll know if we can do this by, say, complete the meeting in just a few more minutes.
Any questions on number 10, on decision point 10.
C, D,
questions E. On 7 and 10.
Commissioner Hanson?
I had questions on 3B and 3C in addition to some of the ones already mentioned,
okay.
And I haven't made it through my list yet. So,
why don't you tell us your questions on B and why don't we put the questions out there about B, C, 7, and 10, and then we'll make a collective judgment about whether we can wrap this up. I think it's fair to say that unless there are extensive questions about the executive director's report, that the rest of the meeting will take just a few minutes. We could be here all night describing the charms of Commissioner Harriman and her contributions, but I think we will. She would be the last person to want us to stay late for that.
Indeed.
Commissioner Hansen, what were your questions about
3B and 3C?
Yeah.
Question about 3B has to do with local candidates who are running for state office. We talk here about city elective office, and I know we've had this conversation before in other contexts, so I'd like to discuss not just city elected office, but people in the city running for office from the city. And my question on 3C is, has to do with the vendor question. So I don't know if we
okay.
dealt
why don't
with
we
that.
Do right? Why don't we do 3B, and could you perhaps sharpen your question, and then I'd be well. Go ahead.
We are focusing only on candidates running for city local office. We do not look at candidates who are running for governor, lieutenant governor.
Do we have authority to do that?
If I may answer that question, give me 1 second.
While she thinks about that, Commissioner Hansen, in the sense that if someone holding office in San Francisco is running for a statewide office, can we get campaign consulting reports about their run for statewide office?
And we do. According what I object to is the deletion of the phrase "any elective office," which is on page 3, line 22. So my concern would be deleting that, because it deletes people running for any elective office, and it narrows now the scope to just people running for local office.
Page
3,
line
22. Under the definition of candidate.
Actually, I
changed the definition, but go ahead.
I agree with you, and I would suggest if we're not going to finish tonight that we come back to you with more definition.
Okay.
Change definition.
That way, right? Oh, well.
Well, if we have questions that are complicated, then we might not be able to finish. I gather that is not a problem for staff in terms of we don't have a deadline on this.
No.
Right.
We want to get it on November ballot, but we don't have a hard and fast deadline.
Yeah, our thinking was if we can maybe we didn't think that we would have finished tonight, but if
okay.
we can finish hopefully next month, that'd be good.
Okay. In that case, and to rather than dive into other ones, I think it might be helpful for you to identify the questions about the other items and 7 and 10, but would it be preferable to do that by email to the staffs just so that they know what to be prepared about, or are there questions of a type that you think would be helpful for other commissioners to take into consideration?
Okay. Could we put the other ones to bed?
The ones that nobody has any
right.
question about?
And you could do an en bloc motion.
Let's see what the questions are about. Are there any questions about 3C, 7, and 10 that you think would be good for the other commissioners to hear
I think if they're going to be taken up in the next meeting, probably can just wait. Sent to staff.
Okay.
At least for mine.
Commissioner Hansen, you're comfortable with that, or would you?
Sure.
Okay. So commissioners will let you know what their questions were about these. In some ways, that might suggest a practice for the future to get those to staff so that we can be thinking about them. But I think this was a good discussion. As far as the remaining ones, 1, 3D, 5C, 5E.
And 11 through 15.
And 11 through 15.
And 2. I'm sorry. Yeah, 2.
I think we did
2 as one of.
We put off the discussion of 2 to the end.
Oh, right.
To the
true,
end. I'm not
true.
Including that.
Why don't we do that one next week as well? Mm-hmm. I don't think we should drop 2 into the block here of technical changes. That one may be one for people to sleep on.
So can you just repeat the list of the
1, 3D, 5C, 5E, 11 through 15. Do I hear a motion to accept those?
I'll make a motion to accept those as listed. Do you want me to relist them?
No.
Okay.
Second?
I'll second.
No public. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. We will come back next week to 2, 3B, 3C, 7, and 10. Next item on the agenda is the election of a vice chair, if that is folks' pleasure. Commissioner Susan Harriman resigned from the commission on November 18th. She is now ensconced in a jurisdiction, resides in a jurisdiction other than the city and county of San Francisco, and so could no longer continue this service to its people. Having been a wonderful commissioner and a very effective and thoughtful chair, she really went above and beyond in taking responsibility for some very complicated matters. And I think I certainly feel that we benefited from her expertise in some matters of first impression or procedures that the commission had never dealt with before, where her knowledge, experience, and clarity really helped us see a way to handle those matters, but also to set precedent and think about the procedures that we should have for the future in those areas. And I found her gracious, helpful, and certainly moved a meeting. And we very much appreciate what she has done for the respect in which the commission is held and for I'll speak for myself, for me as being one of the several commissioners who helped me come on board. Would anyone like to add a quick comment? Don't feel that we have to at this point, but in the interest of time. Did I hear that you might have a letter
I do.
To share with us?
Yes.
Thank you.
Commissioner Harriman wanted me to pass along this short message. Dear members of the Ethics Commission and Mr. St. Croix, I wish to thank each of you for having had the opportunity to work with you. I especially want to thank both John St. Croix and Mabel Ng for the wonderful work that they and their staff do for the City and County of San Francisco. The two of them are a valuable asset to the city, and I was the lucky beneficiary of their great work for the last 5 years. I also greatly enjoyed working with Commissioners Studley, Hansen, Ward, and her, and former Commissioner Kusakuma. Each of you had the qualities that every SF resident should want in a commissioner. You consistently exhibited intelligence, concern about getting to the right decision or result, and a selfless devotion of time to this volunteer job. I'm very privileged to have served with you, Susan.
Thank you. That's very much in the spirit of the collaboration that she had with all of us. We had invited her here tonight to, if she were able to do this in person, but that was not possible, and she very modestly also said that she didn't want to seem to be seeking our applause, but I think the record will speak for itself in her service to the commission. Her departure leaves a vacancy for vice chair, and because there's always the possibility that the chair will not be available, it seems wise for us to fill that position. And I apologize that I didn't have the opportunity to speak to all of the commissioners, but
nothing to apologize for.
Or to open conversation at an earlier meeting because we didn't have a November meeting at the point that we knew that Commissioner Harriman was going to do this.
We wouldn't have
so we can
either.
Now open nominations for vice chair.
I'd like to nominate Commissioner Herr.
And I'd like to nominate Commissioner Hansen. Both of these people would be wonderful vice chairs. My consideration was partly that Commissioner Hansen's term will conclude in 2 months, and so she has a long service that has not been recognized by a chair position. How would four of us vote on two nominees? Challenging. Are you both willing to serve if chosen by the electorate?
Yes. Yes.
We can do this tonight. We don't get much advantage by doing it another time because we can't all talk to each other. Just help me here on the mechanics.
I will just say that I truly appreciate Commissioner Ward's nomination. Having been being the most recent member of the board, having joined only I think 5 or 6 months ago, I'd be more than happy to defer, however, to Commissioner Hansen to be the vice chair.
I appreciate that, and I would say I would be very happy to defer to Commissioner Herr, who will carry on in that role far longer than I will, since my term is expires in February. So I'm not sure which way we're better served. I think either way is fine with me. Thank you.
Me too.
Well, that actually was my thinking in nominating Commissioner Herr, is that he's going to be here, but I understand your
right.
Thinking is just
because Commissioner Hansen won't be.
Well, the office will be revoted on in February, regardless of the outcome, because we select a new chair.
As
so we have 1 month. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe Commissioner Studley should swear on her grave that she will be here
yes.
in January.
And we don't need to concern ourselves with the vice chair now.
I wish I could predict the future that well, and I'm sure that Mr. St. Croix would find somebody to...
There's nothing that says we have to have a vice chair. And if you're not here, then the commissioners that are here select a temporary chair for that meeting. That's the rules.
In the interest of time and not to have to choose between two such fine people, I'm prepared to leave it that way unless somebody feels that they would be deprived.
I think that's a great solution.
Okay. Thank you. We respect you both, and there's no higher title here than commissioner. Let's move through the last items of the agenda. The minutes of the meeting on October 18th were provided in your packet. Are there any corrections, questions, or amendments to the minutes? Hearing none and seeing no members of the public, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The executive director's report.
Okay, I will do this as quickly as I can. First of all, with the budget, I do point out that for next year, all departments have been ordered by the mayor's budget office to submit budgets with a 10% cut plus an additional 10% contingency plan. 2.5% of that cut is being taken out of this year's budget, so I've had to cut $53,256 in spending planned for this year. What we did was to cut in half the remaining balance in all of our small accounts, subpoenas and process serving training fees, what's left of those. And those are very small accounts, and they're $5,000 or less. And we took the rest out of money that we had for temp staff. Although we badly needed them, I didn't hire any temp staff during the recent election period because I was afraid something like this was going to happen. As to the rest of it, we'll be discussing that in the January and February meetings. we encountered a lot of things in the public financing program where we'll need changes. We will bring those to you in the months over next year. I want to point out one technical problem. Item 3 in the ED report says that there were no new complaints since the November meeting. That is technically correct from the date of the November meeting, which we did not have, but there were 4 new complaints added after the between now and the October meeting.
I didn't understand that.
Okay. It says there have been no new complaints since the November 8th meeting.
Right.
That's correct, since November 8th. There were 4 new complaints prior to that since the last meeting.
October to November.
Right. And then I have one thing I want to share with you. We have had some problems maintaining our interested persons list in that there were isolated incidences of people not getting notice. So we've converted to a new and better system. And I want to give you a copy of, this is the annual notice that goes out every year that we're required to do in order to create the interested persons list on the first page that you have here. And that is going out, if it hasn't already gone out, any day now for renewal. There's a different way to subscribe to the interested persons list. It's actually an online process now. So the second page you can see highlighted, you can subscribe right there on our main homepage on the web. And this delivery system will make sure that everybody gets what we're sending them. If a name bounces 5 times, we will remove them from the list because it would generally indicate a dead address. And then the last page is actually the full page that explains the interested persons list for people. So we're doing our best to make sure everybody that's currently on the list re-ups with the new system, and we've beta tested it, and it works a lot better than the old one. So that is an improvement.
We got this today. Or I got it today.
This, okay.
Yes.
So it did go out.
Well, any questions?
One thing, for future correspondence, I guess, until someone else's name, probably should remove Commissioner Harriman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would welcome an opportunity on the agenda in the future to talk about the public financing, just to step back a little and think about how it worked.
We actually publish a report in every cycle, so
yep.
When that report is done, probably in March, we'll have it as an agenda item.
Didn't remember what it was. Anyone else?
I have 2 quick questions. I have several budget questions, but it sounds like in January we will have a discussion with more details about the budget, so I can hold those. And then my second one is on page 3 in terms of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force and the task force asking us to consider a joint open meeting to discuss the proposals. Are we open to that?
Yeah.
Willing to do that?
I asked them if they wanted to do it soon. I almost said expeditiously, or after they were done with their work, and they asked to wait until they're complete.
Okay. And do we have any idea?
We'd be happy to.
when they will be complete. Are we talking the end of the year or beginning of the
year?
Well,
we thought they were going to be done at the end of the year, and they said they won't be, but they haven't indicated to us how long it would take. They can tend to be very process-oriented there, so.
Yes, and I meant end of next year, not this
year.
Oh,
I hope not. No.
Okay. So fairly soon, once the year starts.
I assume they're going to be done sometime in the winter months.
Okay, great. I did have actually one other question, if I might, just this attached FPPC letter, which I guess isn't part of the ED report.
It's referred to in the ED report, which is why we attached it.
Okay. I just really appreciated it. I thought it was a well-written letter, and I'm curious why it was submitted, and do we submit these kinds of things on a regular basis? Were we asked to submit?
No, they had an interested persons meeting, and we're interested people. So they have 3 or 4 a year, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on the subject matter. We go ahead and of our own volition, we go. So in this case, of course, Stephen Massey, who's our tech person, was the one that actually went to Sacramento and made the presentation. And apparently they asked him a number of thoughtful questions.
Do we review on a regular basis what the FPPC is doing? I find a lot of what they're doing interesting and often think, oh, we should be talking about this at the commission.
We sort of follow their agenda. I mean, we do follow their agendas. And then whenever they because we're interested persons, if they have interested person meeting, they send to us. So we do review those things. And there are times when we will send unsolicited comment on some of the decisions they're making, depending on the nature of what it is. And on a rare occasion, the ethics directors from around the state will get together and send a common correspondence if we all agree on something. You know, our latest one when we were doing that was when we were trying to get them to think going all electronic. And in the last incarnation, Deborah Bowen, the Secretary of State, is dedicated to that. But the FPPC sort of did a U-turn with the last appointments that they did not want to go electronic. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of backed up 5 years on that. But that would be an example of something we would all...
I would just submit that it'd be helpful to know when we do that and see copies like this, and if there's anything that you think makes sense for us to discuss in terms of FPPC actions or proposals, that would be important for us to consider. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Are there any items for future meetings? I would suggest, in the interest of time, that you let me or Mr. St. Croix know if you have any such items. There is no public with us to comment on the matters on our agenda. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Happy holidays, everyone.
Thank you. You too. Thank you, everyone.
Please convey our appreciation to the staff for a very busy political season. I should have said that on the record.